You're listening to the 4-Hour City Podcast. I'm Darrell Crouch, the host. Today's episode is sponsored by Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Southeastern desires nothing more than to serve the church and to fulfill the Great Commission. Located in the heart of Wake Forest, North Carolina, Southeastern offers 40 degrees from certificate to PhD using multiple delivery formats. So for more information or to apply, visit sebts.edu. Wherever you're going, Southeastern can help you get there. Jeremiah 29 tells us to seek the welfare of our city, that is, to plant our lives in the city, to pursue peace in the city, to pray for our city. And I really don't know anybody who does that better than my friend and my police chief, James Hambrick. Chief Hambrick's a Navy man. Coming out of the Navy, he started his own janitorial service. He became an ordained minister of the gospel. He worked at a convenience store making ends meet. But in 1995, he became a dispatcher for the Mount Juliet Police Department. He followed that track until he eventually opened his own private counseling service and became a reserve officer and chaplain, but then returned to the force full-time in 2003. In 2005, he earned a PhD in psychology and was named assistant police chief. In 2009, he graduated from Northwestern University School of Police Staff and Command. And then in December 2012, he was named police chief of one of the fastest growing cities in America. In addition to his responsibilities as chief of police, he pastors a local congregation. He served as adjunct professor at Union University. He's authored 2 books. He's married to a wonderful wife, Denise. They have 5 children and 14 grandchildren. I'm really thrilled to have you listen in on this important conversation with Chief James Hambrick. Well, Chief, it's really good to have you on the podcast.
It's good to be here.
Well, you know, right now, Las Vegas is on our mind. We've seen almost 60 people lose their life. Hundreds have been affected. And our country's trying to make sense of all that. Just a few days before the Las Vegas shooting, we had a church shooting on one particular Sunday morning in our own, or in a community near us. Several miles away, but it affected us in a real way. Are these acts of violence random, just out of the blue, or is there something more systemic in our culture that's going on that you see or that you observe in your role as in law enforcement?
I believe that they're random in the fact that I don't believe that the one here near our city had anything to do with the one in Las Vegas, but as you said, from a cultural perspective, these incidents are happening far too frequently in America. And so the fact that those seeds or those thoughts that are planted in individuals' minds, that they would go out and perpetrate that sort of crime or devastation on humanity is just, I don't believe in themselves are random in that regard. Yeah. But as far as having a connection with one with another, I don't certainly believe that.
Sure. And it's been encouraging to see how people have responded to those kinds of crises locally and then again in Las Vegas. There's been so many heroes and first responders, sure, folks that are in your role and EMS roles and so on, and just regular citizens who really step forward. And so it's encouraging to see how we respond to those crises. What can people who follow Jesus do, however, in a more preventative way, to maybe promote peace in our city on an ongoing basis and come beside you and others like you who are serving our city to do just that, promote peace in an environment and a culture of peace?
Well, our faith has to be lived out, and you guys do that here and have been doing that here well. It has to be lived out in the community. People have to see, and it has to be genuine. People see fakeness all day long. They know fakeness when they see it. So it has to be lived out. Prayer has to be preeminent. I told our congregation and others this past Sunday, you know, because of these incidents, people are talking more and more about church security and things like that. And, you know, while I said the talk is about Glock and Smith & Wesson and Ruger, those things cannot take and should not take substitute a prayer, the power of a praying church. The power of prayer still has to be prevalent and real. We know that, you know, there are certain security measures that should happen because the scripture, we're admonished to be wise as serpents but harmless as doves. So we have to take necessary steps to protect our congregations. But at the same time, the power of prayer has to prevail in all of this.
That's so good. I appreciate you calling us to that, not only in a role as a pastor, but as a public servant as well. I want to talk a little bit about race relations and law enforcement and community work. As an African-American police chief in a predominantly white community, we're in a suburb of Nashville, Tennessee, Mount Juliet, Tennessee, about 31,000 folks that you're responsible for. When you see the tensions and a lot of the offenses that take place between law enforcement and the black community, or law enforcement and the white community, or however that comes down in cities across our nation, how do you process that as someone that's in the middle of it, that is on the front lines of it? How is it that you work through that and process and evaluate really where we are as a nation?
Well, first of all, understanding that there is issues. There's an issue with it, and to some it's perceived, but in America we do have real issues. We have to identify that there are real issues first, and then you talk about what to do about it. After we certainly know prayer is the first step, but then there are two elements that I will hear, and I will sound like a broken record, so to speak, here, because this is just a trek that I'm on. What has to happen is we have to have love for one another, mankind, white, black, yeah, it doesn't matter, and we have to respect one another. Now, some kind of way, it's been interjected that there has to be agreement, and we're not going to always agree. And I don't think that should be the ultimate goal of getting to agreement. But what we have to have is we have to have love for our fellow man, and we have to have respect for our fellow man. And I think that's where there's been a breakdown and a lack thereof. And so if we get those things together, I believe that the rest of it will come together. And we have to be willing to come together in forums, to sit down one with another, and to be able to hear from one another. You know, in the counseling arena, the best thing we can do is have that ability to be able to listen and to hear from somebody. And so I believe that should permeate even in this culture and society. If we're going to bring about a healing within race relations, those things have to be there.
Yeah, that's so good. It seems like we find ourselves wanting to camp out in a political spectrum, but the solutions really aren't in the political realm, are they?
No, they're not. Yeah. Again, once we say and acknowledge that we have a problem, we have issues, and then go about, well, now that we know and understand that we're not hiding, we're bringing it to the forefront, there are issues, there are problems, now what do we do about them? And then being able to come together and to sit down together and to, you know, because you hear this a lot within, as it involves race relations, well, they don't understand, and they're not in my shoes. They have been in my shoes, but maybe that's true. Maybe that's a true statement, but they never will be in the shoes. You know, we never will be in one another's shoes. So the ability to come together and hear one another out and to give some understanding. I don't believe any of us will fully understand another race. You know, I'm a African American. I'm black male. I'll never understand all the dynamics of being a white male. just not going to happen. But being able to respect, and see, that's why I said the love and respect factor. Not that I have to understand everything, but I should be able to respect. We're not going to always agree on everything. And so the agreeing is not the total goal, just to love and respect one another as men and as women, as humanity, as humans, and as children of God, then I think that's when healing begins to take place.
Yeah, I love that. Well, you also deal with some really important issues in our city and that are affecting every city across the United States, really, and that's the substance abuse, particularly with respect to opiates and the opiate crisis. And I heard several months ago, if peanut butter was hurting as many people as opiates are hurting people, we wouldn't be able to buy peanut butter anymore. And so it's a pretty significant issue in our own community. Can you talk about that? And this is a fairly medium-sized but growing community mm-hmm. that we live in. What's the effect here, and what's the way forward?
Well, first of all, this epidemic, I would call it, is impacting everyone. I mean, everyone. There's not a community that's not affected by it. There's not a family that hadn't been impacted in some form or way by it. And it's out there. And people say, well, how did we get to this point? Well, we get to this point because of people becoming addicted to painkillers, pain medications. And some, not everyone, has set out in the arena of it to get high. It's not how it started. Some people had legitimate issues, health concerns, challenges, surgeries, and things that they were prescribed these painkillers and became addicted to it. And so it's morphed now into and it gravitated to going from just the painkillers to other opiates, heroin, and it's just been a game changer because it's not that just the heroin is out here on its own. Now fentanyl is been abused and been put into the heroin, and we've even seen now that the fentanyl is being laced into marijuana, and so it's just all the time now going, you know, getting more and more out into the marketplace, I would use that term, and impacting people, and it's taking people out of here. Those that are listening may not know what fentanyl is. Well, fentanyl is a tranquilizer, and when you have fentanyl and carfentanil, to give you, most people have heard of morphine. Well, fentanyl is 100 times more potent or powerful than morphine. And now carfentanil is 10,000 times more powerful than morphine. And these are things that are they use the term lacing the other drugs with, or mixing the other drugs. And it's taking people out of here. People are dying because of it. And it's impacting every community in these United States. I mean, it's... just had some training on this in the last couple of days, and to see just the devastation of lives. And right here in Mount Juliet now, all of our officers, we carry Narcan. Man, we're police officers. We have no business carrying Narcan. But because of the epidemic and because to save our own or someone else, we're carrying Narcan now.
And that's because the drugs can be absorbed through the skin?
Correct.
Yeah. And so Narcan prevents that, helps to prevent that.
It helps if that happens, then we have in the Narcan, we have it's a spray, nasal dose to be able to give you an example. There was a law enforcement officer in another community that made a drug bust, made a traffic stop, made arrests and drugs. A little later on, he was just saw something on his uniform, and he brushed it off with his hand, not thinking about it. Well, it was fentanyl. Got into his skin, and he OD'd, and they had to give him multiple doses of Narcan to revive him. And so we carry it in the fact in case one of our officers gets contact with it and overdoses, or if we arrive on the scene of someone that's overdosed, hopefully we can administer and help save a life. And
yeah,
that's what it's, that's all about. But this is all across America now, yeah, that this is transpiring. And we, through education, and again, I use the term, I don't discount prayer, but we need prayer in this regard as well. But through education and getting people that are impacted, addicted, to get them the help that they need and find, again, I've told our people that this is one issue that we're not going to arrest our way out of. It's just not going to happen. And so trying to get people the help they need to get in recovery and things like that and get into treatment is where we want to be now, because we have to do, if you always do the same things and you don't see any fruit of it,
yeah,
it's time to change, you know, and we have to know what our true mission and calling is in law enforcement. We're here to protect and serve. And so one of those ways is not just by taking someone to jail, but by getting them the help that they need.
Yeah, one of the things that I know in our church, we've identified at least four areas of vulnerability in our city, or at least four goals that we have. And one of those goals is that everybody's clean, that the drug epidemic is not an epidemic here, that people get the help they need, and so that wholeness and life can really be a reality for them. But the truth is, we're really not very well equipped sometimes to do that, or we don't really know what the next step is. So as you're asking us to pray and come beside you, what are some practical ways that people of faith can engage on this particular epidemic in our community and communities around the country? What are ways that the church can come beside you in practical ways to help folks get themselves out of this?
One is to be able to identify, if, and when I say identify, if there are people that are known, that the church knows of, and then, you know, partner with us to get them the help they need. That's one. The second thing is that we could do one of two things. We could walk by them, as in the story of the Good Samaritan. We can walk by, or we can engage and not be afraid to engage them, as has been done with homelessness and people that are homeless and different things like that. And it's now time for the church and law enforcement, all of those that are in service-oriented industries, to not be afraid and to engage these individuals, because they are human beings and they're in need of the same love and compassion that we desire. And so we have to not be afraid, and we have to engage them. And when I'm saying that, I'm not saying through reckless abandonment to put all caution to the wind. I'm just saying that there should be a way that we engage these individuals that are hurting, that are needing help, and try to lead them and guide them into getting the help that they need. Because just if we just walk by them, the problem is not going to go away on its own.
Yeah,
it would just get greater and greater. And if we want to be responsible community members, then we have to not be afraid to engage in conversation with one another. And when we see someone that's hurting, I mean, just engaging them with love and with compassion. And now, is everyone going to accept that? Maybe not, but we have to start somewhere.
Yeah. It seems like if we can create a little bit of margin in our life to stop, you know, that the Good Samaritan, it seems like he was going somewhere, had somewhere to be, was heading out somewhere, but he still had margin in his life that he was willing to stop, take a detour from his own particular agenda,
sure,
and get involved. And sometimes I feel like because we're not all trained, or because we don't have a background in that, or we don't have experience in that, then we assume somebody else should engage, when really that expertise or education is really not the first criteria, or the first qualification, rather, but it's just a willingness to be involved in somebody's life.
Sure, and I think one of the things is if we can get to a place to where, like you said, maybe we're not the professionals, maybe we're not the ones, but being able to identify and know where we can, you know, lead someone to and contact those people that are in those professions and get those, you know, individuals the help that they need. And we use the old cliche, but one at a time, you know.
Yeah.
It's done one at a time. And I just believe, you know, people have said in our community that it could be a lot worse. And they're right, correct, you know, but it can be better also.
Right.
So, you know, we've lost too many, even here within our own community, to this epidemic. And I don't want to lose anyone. Don't want to lose one more. You know, we can't bring those that have gone back, but we can do something from this point forward in helping people get the help and treatment they need. Because, again, it's not going to go away on its own.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate all that. You know, I want to turn the conversation a little bit to talk about your personal journey. You wear a lot of hats. I think that's probably the way you've been built all your life, to be involved in a lot of different things. But you're a husband and a father and grandfather, and you're a police chief in one of the fastest growing communities in this part of the country anyway. You're a published author, a bivocational pastor of a predominantly white church, by the way. How does all that happen? I mean, what were some landmarks or some real important influences in your life that have helped to shape you and equip you for the role that you're in now, and all the roles that you're in now?
Well, sometimes when I look at my life and the different parts of my life that I'm in, even with policing, you know, you could see, you hear the old adage, man, I didn't see that coming. Well, trust me, I got family that says, man, I didn't see that coming. You know, of all the people in our family, him, police officer. So the Lord has been good. And I'm asked that question all the time. How do I do all the things that I do? And that's one word. And I know it's, again, sometimes it sounds like a broken record with me saying it, but the word servant, that's all I am. Whether it's policing, pastoring, teaching, counseling, I'm just a servant. And in each one of the various occupations or job titles or hats, as you said, they will wear, I all of them come under that one heading, servant. And, you know, I don't see myself as nothing more, nothing less. And so even, you know, you have to have a balance within your life, and, you know, you create a balance through understanding and prioritizing and being, I tell people all the time, I'm just trying to be the best James I can be. I can't be anyone else. And so balancing that family time, loving the family time, and it's easier when you try to do that according to the way the scriptures and God is set forth. And so, again, I'm just a servant.
Yeah, that's so cool, because what we know is that Jesus was a servant. We know that he called his disciples to be servants. We know that Jeremiah, a long time before that, said, I want you to serve the city. I want you to pursue peace in the city. And so sometimes I think maybe it's because of culture among evangelical Christians or evangelical churches, that we might assume that serving has to be on the rails of a program that our church or our pastor or somebody tells us to be a part of. But really, it's an overflow of our life in Christ, that we see who we are. You're the best James you can be. I'm the best Daryl I can be, and who God's created us to be. And out of the overflow of a relationship with Jesus, then we serve whatever opportunities that he gives to us.
Because we live it. We're busy. We're busy people. You're a busy pastor. We're busy people in this day and time. 2017, you know, we're busy people. But the thing of it is, and we do many things, one of the keys for me is, can we do what we do with a pure, you know, with pure hearts and with genuineness and with compassion? If we can do that, and then that makes the transition of going from police chief to pastor to counselor, and make, if we can be genuine and have that compassion and that servant's heart, it connects that a lot smoothly. That, you know, it's almost seamless, so to a point.
Right. We don't live in compartments where we turn it off in one area and turn it on in another area. Yes. We are who we are and across the board, and that gives us opportunity in whatever domain of life God puts us in.
Sure, because as the apostle said, by the grace of God, I am what I am. And yeah. So, again, nothing more and nothing less than a servant.
Well, your police department kind of, not kind of, but in a very real way, reflects that heart of a servant. And you've kind of approached police work a little bit different, maybe, in our community than some communities might approach it. And I know I still, when I see a police car or SUV coming down, I still, you know, slam on the brakes because of a guilty, shameful conscience, but like most of us do. But that's really not the approach that you've taken in serving this community. Can you talk about that and just what that has looked like and why that's important to be so engaged in building goodwill in the community?
Well, I'm just of the things that, not in a pride way, but I am proud in the way that our officers have bought in. And because when you're trying to create a certain culture, it only works to the extent that your officers buy in, and you receive buy-in from whether it be church, or whether it be any organization. You have to have buy-in. And I tell them, we want to police with professionalism, but we want to police and be approachable. And those are some of the things, some of the comments that I get, especially as you stated in the opening, that we're growing, a very growing, fast-growing city, and people have moved here from everywhere. And when I get comments that, Chief, your guys out here is just, you know, they're approachable, they're visible, then you can go up to them and have conversation with them. And those are the type of dynamics that we've tried to create. I have always been against the thing of us against them mentality that some police agencies have. I've never bought into that, even when I was just a patrolman. That wasn't my mindset. Our motto here in Mount Juliet is community strong, and we try to make that just permeate throughout this entire city. We've been blessed by it, because I tell our force that at the end of the day, it's the community that's going to have our back. And really, the criminal element of a city, of any city, of this nation, the criminal element is 1-2% of the population. Make no mistake about it, we're still out to get the bad guy. We do that. But my main focus is, how do we engage effectively the 98% that are not the criminal element? Because at the end of the day, as I said, that's who's going to have my back at the end of the day. And so I want to be approachable. I want to be, I have an open door that where the citizens can come. We do different things, the coffee with the cops and the different programs that we do. And we want to keep those things going, because as our younger people are coming up, you know, it's one thing that they hear or see on TV what's going on the national level, when they see all the different high profile cases that they've seen, or on Facebook or whatever, social media, of a negative police encounter or interaction. And so I want them to be bombarded or in a culture where positive things are going on, and they see realness. Even though they may see one thing on television or hear one thing or see it on social media, they have something to counter that by real life experience here in the Mount Juliet area. And so we're just trying to do, I say all the time, we're not perfect, but we're trying to do it the right way here in Mount Juliet.
Well, it really shows, and it makes a difference in the culture of the city. And it makes a difference when my kids see you out and are able to engage you in a positive way. It prepares them for when there is something that's more difficult, and there's already a relationship in place, and you're not strangers, and it's not uncommon to engage with you. So That really makes a difference. Well, let me wrap this up a little bit, or pretty soon here, with this last question. And, you know, you and some others in our community, we've all kind of worked together and praying together and dreaming together about what city transformation can really look like, and sure, praying for a Jesus movement in our city and whatever that might look like. We understand that God's work is much bigger than one church, mm-hmm, that He really is building a kingdom that's bigger than one of our local congregations. And so that's pretty exciting. So from your perspective, what are some of the best ways that people of God in this community or any community that of where people may be listening can engage and serve their city for the sake of the kingdom?
Well, again, getting beyond walls and getting beyond the traditional church hour, I would use that term, and just about being transparent, being genuine, being out in community with prayer, engaging people, not being afraid of their faith, of our faith, and in the marketplace, what we have, because I say it all the time, we in church, we do Sunday well. We do Sunday real well. And so the job is, or the task at hand is, how do we go from Sunday and do Monday through Saturday as well as we do Sunday? And I think when we're doing that, what we do on Sunday, when we're doing it as a lifestyle, and you know, I'll say it in a term like this, the church has to be brought into focus that it's who we are and not where we go. And you know, when it starts becoming the building that we go to, then we'll start accomplishing even more for the kingdom. But I just think in praying one for another, supporting one another, certainly in prayer, but when we're engaging people in the marketplace and dealing with them, sharing Christ with them, and just building up one another. You know, I have no problem building Green Hill up because the Barn Church is not for everybody. You know, I have no problem building any church that's established and that I see that's about kingdom business. I have no problem, you know, telling people in the marketplace about them. But we just have to be transparent. And again, I found this to be true in whatever area we're in, whether it be counseling, policing, school, genuineness, and not being fake or phony is key. I mean, it is just key, because people read us as well.
Well, I'm so grateful you live that out, and I'm grateful that for your friendship. I'm grateful for the way that you lead our city, the example that you set for our city. God is doing a good work in our particular community. Our police chief, our fire chief, our city manager, a lot of our educators and nonprofit leaders and business leaders want to see God do a great work, and you're on the forefront of that, and I couldn't be more thrilled, and I appreciate your friendship.
Hey, I appreciate it.
And I appreciate that, and just you being on the podcast today and helping us think through some of these issues that are really important at the local level. So God bless you.
Hey, God bless you, Darren. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening in to the For Our City podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation with my friend and my police chief, James Hambrick. He not only talks about prayer and love and respect and service, he really does live that out. It's a reminder to me, and I hope to you, that our walk with Jesus is really an invitation to advance the kingdom of God by serving our community in whatever domain that He has given to us. City transformation is really possible when we live out our faith like that. And so if you've enjoyed the podcast, I encourage you to subscribe at iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play. You can also visit forourcity.us. That would be awesome. Give us good ratings. Tell your friends about it. And until next time, let's live for our city.